James L. Kugel, star professor emeritus of Hebrew literature at Harvard University, is one of the most influential biblical scholars of the present era. In his wide-ranging body of work, both painstakingly researched and written in clear and compelling language, Professor Kugel has illuminated the Hebrew Bible, its sources and methods, but also the world and the cultures that produced it. In How to Read the Bible, for which he received the National Jewish Book Award in 2007, Professor Kugel explored not only the Bible as an anthology gradually edited and redacted over millennia, but also the rise of modern biblical scholarship and how it influenced the way we read the Bible, and thus, as a result, the way we understand ourselves and the wider world. In The Bible as It Was, Professor Kugel analyzed biblical passages through their ancient interpreters, then traced the evolution of the interpretation through the history of thought and Jewish exegesis. In numerous other books, scholarly articles, and through decades as a renowned teacher and lecturer, Professor Kugel has exerted a profound influence on biblical scholars and scholarship. He joins me today to discuss his new book, The Great Shift, Encountering God in Biblical Times, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Professor Kugel, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
So in the foreword to this book, you refer to it as your last book. Why?
Well, I'm getting a little long in the tooth, I wasn't quite as straightforward. I really meant it's my last book aimed at a wide audience. The next thing on my desk is supposed to be a rather scholarly, boring commentary on an obscure text called the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs, a Jewish text going back to about the first, maybe even second century before the Common Era.
Uh-huh.
So I have to sit down, and I have a lot of that done, but I do think that's still on the way.
So you have, throughout your career, really produced detailed biblical scholarship, as I mentioned, but you've also written for a broader audience. Which category does this book fall into, or does it fall into both? Because it has an extensive bibliography and footnotes, and it's a wide-ranging but very accessible book.
Well, nice of you to say. That's what I intended. I really wrote in parallel the extensive footnotes and the text itself. The text itself is really meant to speak to every reader, and I don't think it's hard to get through. I wrote the extensive footnotes because a lot of these questions that I deal with are still open to debate, and here and there I wanted to put in my own ideas, but mostly aimed at my own colleagues rather than the general reader.
Right, right. Now, just so our listeners know right off the bat, the title of the book is The Great Shift, Encountering God in Biblical Times. And what is the shift that the title refers to?
Well, I guess the beginning of the story goes back to lots of pretty ancient biblical narratives that talk about how human beings, Abraham and Moses and so forth, actually encountered God. And in these narratives, God is presented in a certain way. And then as time goes on, these encounters become different. And so I really wanted to, they become sort of more abstract, and I wanted to try to understand how that happened and why. That's really the whole purpose of the book. It's about this kind of shift in what it means to encounter God. I guess to go from, the time of Abraham to the sermon you might have heard in church or synagogue last week, mm-hmm. and how different those two gods are.
And so people, characters in the Bible really do experience God in immediate and sometimes overpowering ways, but it seems that they don't always understand that that's what's happening. Is that right?
Well, that's right. There are all these narratives that involve angels. I should say parenthetically, I've never really been happy with the term angel, because the Hebrew word malach, which is used, really means more of a, you know, messenger, somebody or something that is sent. And when we think of angels, I guess we think of those people with the flowing robes and, you know, the halos on their heads,
right.
That come with your calendars from your synagogue. But that's not how they are in the Bible. They, you know, seem mostly to look just like ordinary human beings. And at first, that's what, you know, Abraham and company think they are. And then after a while, they seem to have this kind of period of confusion. They themselves are in a kind of fog, as if the most obvious things somehow escape their attention, and they don't realize that this person that they're talking to isn't like an ordinary person. And then after this moment of confusion, which can actually drag on for a while, they suddenly realize that this isn't just an ordinary human. And at that point, that messenger, that angel, kind of begins to fade, and at least often. And then it's just God's voice talking, a kind of disembodied voice talking to Abraham, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That happens so much. I mean, I think I gave 7 or 8 examples of that in this book. That happens so much that, you know, there seems to be a pattern here. And it may be, as I said, that, you know, narratives sometimes obey conventions, but the question is really, what is the convention trying to tell us? So what is the nature of this sort of encounter with God?
Right. So the book notices and you give beautiful and detailed analyses of these encounters, and then something changes. Something happens, and this is this something is what gives its book your title, and I would characterize it as a gradual shift away from immediate and in many ways intimate encounters with God to encounters that require more and more interpretation, either by the individuals experiencing it, or by the culture as a whole, or by the narrator, or by the reader, or perhaps all of the above. What are the essences or motive forces of the shift? You just noted correctly, I think, that perhaps these narratives were just obeying convention, but were conventions changing? What was changing in the ancient Near East that might have been causing this shift in the way God was experienced or depicted?
Well, that is indeed the question that the book is out to answer. And it seems that a lot of things changed separately and altogether had created this great shift. I should say, in parentheses, I hesitated for a while about what to call the book. And I guess I like shift better than change, which was another idea that we batted about.
Mm-hmm.
A shift to me, I don't know, maybe it's just because of baseball and football, but it seems to involve more than just, you know, one moving part. And that is really the story I'm after, that different things changed, and they all seem to be symptomatic of a kind of fundamental change in what is really, I guess, the unspoken subject of this book, the sense of self, as it's called by anthropologists.
Mm-hmm.
And psychologists and so forth.
You have consulted these other disciplines, which is quite interesting. You've gone into not only anthropology and psychology, as you said, but neuroscience in order to understand this shift. How did those disciplines provide you with additional perspective or information on what constituted this shift?
Well, I think, you know, the sense of self, as a term, really means the kind of idea of who I am, what my mind can do and not do, that people carry around in their heads. And everybody has a sense of self, but they vary greatly across the globe and over the centuries. And I guess most people, I include myself in that, when they read these stories in the Bible, they assume that the people involved had the same sense of self that we have. But there's really no reason to assume that, since even now in lots of the globe, you know, lots of different societies, people do have strikingly different senses of self. If you go back in for a few centuries, even the modern Western sense of self starts to look rather different. So what I wanted to do in this book was to try to figure out how people in the time of Abraham or Moses thought about themselves. What did they think could happen to them, or what their minds were, and how that's a bit different from what we do.
Mm-hmm. And it does seem from what reading I've done in cognitive psychology and neuroscience that we are discovering from a scientific perspective that we are, in fact, to use your term, semi-permeable selves. In other words, Western epistemology has given us an idea that we are masters of our own fate and that we are self-contained. And you talk about the evolution of the idea of the soul as something individual and almost customized and implanted within someone. But neuroscience has begun to suggest that we sort of inter-exist with others. Are there specific passages in the Hebrew Bible where you see that happening and that informed your work in this book?
Well, I mean, just reading along in Genesis, sometimes, you know, and one of the things that struck me was how different the kind of sense of self that Joseph has is from, you know, the other stories in Genesis. The other stories in Genesis, it just seems to be assumed that some external force, God or elsewhere in Jewish writings, wicked angels and so forth, they are external, but they can kind of penetrate your brain and plant words in your mouth, as happens with Israel's prophets, or, you know, cause you to behave in a way that you might not have wanted to. That also happens a good bit. Mm-hmm. Going back to this book I mentioned, I might, you know, someday finish this commentary on it, The Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs. Uh-huh. That was really, I think that was what really got me going on this subject, because this is a book by an author who's very interested in the question of why people sin. You know, there are basically two explanations for human sinfulness in the book. Uh-huh. One of them is that somehow there's something inside of us that, you know, what is called later on in Judaism the Yetzer or Yetzer Hara, mm-hmm. the impulse to do evil. And that just somehow wins out now and then. And so we find ourselves doing things that we really didn't want to do, but, you know, it was just in there pushing us to do this.
Right.
The other explanation is that Satan, or some Satan-like wicked angel, has a bunch of emissaries. They're not called malachim, they're called ruchot, spirits. And he emits these spirits. They all have different names. There's the spirit of fornication, and the spirit of anger, and the spirit of and so forth. And he sends these out to people, and they're able to kind of penetrate our brains and make us do what we do. I hope I'm not overreaching here, but I think most modern Westerners would say, well, no contest. The first is what's really going on. We're responsible right. for what we do.
Right.
But what's so interesting about this book is the author just can't make up his mind. Sometimes he says the one, sometimes he says the other, and a lot of times he tries to combine the two into one explanation that really doesn't hold together. So that is what got me to thinking about you know, what we really believe about ourselves, as you were saying.
Yeah.
We nowadays think of ourselves in the modern West as altogether self-enclosed, and nothing from the outside really gets in. Somebody, I don't know who, coined the acronym for our particular mentality, the weird world, where W stands for Western, E stands for educated, I for industrialized, and so forth. I forget the other two.
But I guess developed.
We are very different from most of the rest of the world, and we're very different from our own past. We have as much of a self-created picture of what we are like and what our minds are as any other period in human history or any other part of the globe right now.
Right.
And as anthropologists will certainly tell you, there's a great deal of variety even now from society to society.
You talk, and we talked about this for a moment earlier, perhaps one character, one biblical character who really embodies or personifies the shift in the perspective of God is the character of Joseph, for whom you note that God is not really an intimate encounter, but more of a long-range planner who arranges but doesn't intervene in human affairs. And you note that Joseph cites the hand of God in the events that transpire in his life story and the story of his family, but he never addresses God directly. What does this tell us about the changing nature of God and how much it was affected by changes in culture and society? Because Joseph really, as you know, embodies a massive shift in the location and the culture of Israelite worship.
Well, I mean, you said it very well. The fact is, Joseph never prays. You know, he's in lots of tough straits. But he always, you know, his own pluck and determination gets him out. You know, his brothers want to kill him, and somehow he survives that. Then he's sold as a slave, and he rises to the top of the household staff, and then he's falsely accused of attempted rape, and then he's down again. And he comes out of all of these things, really, thanks to his own optimistic and determined nature. But he doesn't... He doesn't turn to God for help. This is very surprising in the, you know, context of the stories around it. And I guess it would have been surprising even to later readers, where it was really kind of conventional. If you're in tough straits, you turn to God, and then afterwards you offer thanks. He never thanks God for anything. This was clearly a somewhat different sense of self and a sense of what the encounter between God and humans is. As you said, he's really the long-range planner, the person who arranges everything in advance and then kind of sits back and watches reality unfold.
Right. But does Joseph's story reflect the different ways that we think about prayer? In other words, did earlier biblical figures pray the way contemporary worshipers pray? Did the more intimate encounters indicate a God who could just be approached in a non-liturgical and in relatively informal and spontaneous setting? Or does Joseph really represent a departure in praxis?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. And I have to say, in general, I haven't been very successful about tracing a kind of straight line development. This great shift, you know, goes back and forth. And even at the end of the biblical period, in the time of the testaments of the 12 patriarchs, these people are, you know, their minds are still penetrable by evil forces. God doesn't seem to enter into their minds, but that did. You know, surprisingly long survive in the human sense of self, at least in ancient Israel. But as far as Joseph is concerned, it's true. He makes reference to God, and Pharaoh at one point says, "I'm looking for somebody. Is there anybody in whom the spirit of God resides more than in this fellow Joseph?" But even that is kind of far away from the other figures we see in Genesis and Exodus. To begin with, they're really not eager to meet God.
Yeah.
I think I said in the book, it's a little bit like living in the modern Middle East. You know, if you're really desperate for help, you might turn to the government, but you never know what that's going to get you involved in.
Right.
And, I think that was true in Joseph's days. Anyway, those other biblical figures do turn to God. But as I think about it, there are narratives, but there are also prayers that we have in the book of Psalms and other representations of people in the prophets calling out to God for help or receiving messages from God to distribute. All those have to be kind of considered together in order to get a composite picture of what was going on.
Right. And I did want to turn to the subject of the Book of Psalms and the heartfelt but still often more liturgically formal approach to God depicted in the Psalms. The cries for help that are so prevalent in the Psalms indicate, and I think you say this in the book, a God who might be more distant and who is summoned by the cry of the victim. And I'm wondering how your research on and your exploration of the Psalms reflects on the idea of the semi-permeable self. Now, clearly the Psalms are written over a long period of time and redacted over a long period of time, have numerous authors, at least that's what biblical scholarship has deduced on the basis of the evidence. But the question is, to what extent do the Psalms reflect and to what extent do they influence the gradual erosion of the semi-permeable self? And I guess that question's true about the Bible as a whole. To what extent do you see the semi-permeable self as a creation of the Bible, and to what extent is it eroded by the biblical sense of self, if one can use that broad term?
Right, that's a good broad term to use. I think what the picture that emerges from the oldest Psalms that we can identify is of a God who's I like to say just on the other side of the curtain, mm-hmm. that separates the ordinary from the extraordinary. God is on the extraordinary side, and he's not far away. It's just the other side of the curtain. The problem is you have to get him to want to act, and that's why people who pray describe in sometimes painful detail how difficult and what difficulties they are and how much they need divine help. I guess the operating assumption is, if you're not absolutely desperate, don't bother calling me because I got a lot of people. But he's not distant. He's just on the other side of that curtain. And then as time goes on, God, in general, seems to become more and more remote. Think again about Joseph's God, sort of the long-range planner who is, apparently far away. And the reason why Joseph never prays is because if God has planned everything out in advance, there's really no reason or possibility to ask him to change his plans. Those are eternal. But that wasn't the way it was in an earlier day, and as time goes on, God does seem to become more and more remote. One of the interesting things is, the whole story of prophecy in the so-called classical prophets. You know, people like Hosea or Amos or Isaiah. God speaks directly to them. He says, here's what I want you to say.
Yeah.
And then they have to go and say it, even if it's painful or in some cases results in their being ostracized. But it's all right.
Right.
This is what I want you to say. Later on, it doesn't happen like that. Now, God no longer has, in late biblical prophecy, he doesn't have direct contact with the prophet. An angel or some sort of representative will talk to the human being, but God seems to be in the highest heaven while this is taking place. So that certainly is a significant change.
Absolutely. And I want to come back to the subject of prophecy, but I'm interested to hear more from you about the text. The text critical approach has revealed the different, at least the documentary hypothesis holds that there are different sources that we can clearly identify as becoming sort of interwoven into the text, that is the Hebrew Bible. And in the P source, the priestly documents in the Bible reflect a sort of cold and impersonal deity, one that uses impersonal and, if one could say, even almost bureaucratic language. And this reflects, I think, the institutionalization of sacrifice and the creation and ongoing maintenance of a sacrificial cult. Do you talk in the book, and can you tell us about it, about how sacrifice influences the notion of the semi-permeable self and how it reflects or influences the distant God?
Well, I think sacrifice just always was the principal means of communication between human beings and deities throughout the ancient Near East. People thought about, turning to God with words as really, the last choice. If all you could do was speak, then that was just words and it didn't really count. What counted was offering a sacrifice. And we certainly see, early narratives that refer to individual people, even if they didn't have a temple, they, went to an altar, built an altar, and then lifted up their voice, but also their sacrifice to God. I think if you go, and I have to say, the priesthood was an institution. These, there's a whole bunch of people who were connected to this sacred building or other sacred buildings, and mm-hmm. their business was offering sacrifices. That was so much the case that, again, this isn't anything I discovered, but modern scholars have realized that that priestly texts really don't talk about praying to God. Their whole operation is based on offering these sacrifices, and Jews continue to sacrifice in the Jerusalem temple until its destruction by the Romans in the first century of the Common Era. So that, in a sense, never changed. But what did change along with that was the nature of the prayers that people spoke and where they spoke them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, please continue.
Well, I was going to say one thing scholars have noticed is on with psalms that are datable to a very late period in in Second Temple times, let's say, these psalms don't seem to be asking for anything. They just want to have the person who's speaking them or the people who are speaking them stress that they're just offering praise to God. That doesn't involve sacrifices or anything, but just speaking as an individual or as a group and offering verbal praise to God. It seems like they're just kind of trying to establish contact with this now rather remote deity.
Which is interesting because my next question is about the emergence that you talk about of a religion of laws. And the way that God is depicted as a kind of conquering suzerain, first and foremost because he demanded absolute loyalty and the avoidance of any foreign entanglements. So with the emergence and the creation of a religion of laws, which goes hand in hand with the creation of an established sacrificial cult, we have a cultural context in which suzerainty treaties are the way societies are governed, and this is the way God comes to be seen. This section in your book is proximate to a section about a new inwardness and the emerging concept of the soul. I would just wonder if you could talk about those two ideas in conjunction with or juxtaposition with each other. Is there some sort of relationship between the emergence of a religion of laws and the new inwardness, the less permeable self that you talk about emerging?
Well, I think the idea of a religion of laws has to be seen in its broader ancient Near Eastern context. Mm-hmm. The laws that we have involve all sorts of things, criminal law and cultic law. That's things relating to the offering of sacrifices and what goes on in a temple, relations between, individuals, mothers and fathers with their children and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Anyway, those are, I think in the broader context, this is a rather weird idea. You serve God in Mesopotamia by offering sacrifices. And, you don't really know what's going to happen, but you need to kind of maintain this ongoing service of God and just hope for the best. But there's nothing about, serving me via doing all these things that I demand of you. In fact, that verb, la'avod, to serve or to work for, and I forget about the lexical item, but the idea is certainly one throughout the ancient Near East, but it generally refers to offering sacrifices. Suddenly, in the book of Deuteronomy and a few other places, you have people who are serving God by keeping these laws. So that was a very, very important change. And along with that, what you mentioned is the kind of evolution of the soul. This was really quite interesting for me to observe. Mm-hmm. Souls have always been around, right? But that isn't really true. There were basically three Hebrew words that designated three Hebrew words that are translated as soul in the Bible. But in the earliest parts of the Bible, they really, don't mean soul for the most part.
Right.
They mean me, myself, mm-hmm. and or a whole person. In fact, all living things, that can be called nefesh. In any case, that's the way things seemed for a long time. And then after a while, suddenly these words seem to refer not to the whole person, but to something special inside the person, a special part of me, and one that eventually becomes separable from me. It can leave my body when I die, or leave my body every night while I'm asleep. So that was a significant change in the whole idea, and it became obscured because since those same words now meant soul, you could go back to earlier parts of the Bible when they didn't and be mistaken and think that that's what they were meaning. So all over the Bible are souls that are really not souls; they're just me.
Yeah.
But then they become this kind of special thing. And I guess I couldn't stop from suggesting that this new special part of me had something to do with a rather more remote God.
Mm-hmm. In your section in the book, chapter 12, on remembering God, you spend some time and shed really interesting insight on one of the most perplexing stories in the Bible, and that is the story of Moses striking the rock and then immediately being told by God that since you did not show your trust in me, sanctifying me in the Israelites' sight, you will not lead this congregation to the land that I'm giving them. That's in Numbers chapter 20. Can you talk a little bit about your exegesis of and your understanding of that chapter and what it tells us about the changing conception of and relationship with God and the changing conception of the self?
Well, I should perhaps start by saying a modern biblical scholar, and I certainly wear that hat from time to time.
Right.
Would say, well, these are just they're doublets. There are two versions of this story: one in the book of Exodus and one in Numbers. And in Exodus, it's an altogether good thing. God, you know, the people are don't have enough water to drink, and then God tells Moses to strike this rock, and he strikes the rock, and the water comes out, and everything's fine. And then the second occurrence, 40 years later or so, they're nearing the, their entrance into the land that has been given to their ancestors. And then there's not enough water. And so God tells us to, and this is tricky, and I perhaps shouldn't get caught up in details, but basically he says for them to strike this rock. Moses and Aaron, and they do so, and then God says, well, because you didn't show your face in me, presumably the watching Israelites, I'm not going to let you go into the promised land. If one takes these as purposefully differentiated, one could see that what the real problem, I'm sorry, lots of biblical commentators talk about this, and they want to know what was so bad about what Moses did, and there are various answers. But the most obvious answer is what the text says, that you didn't call on God to do this miracle, but you acted as if you and Aaron were doing it all yourselves, and that was a classic instance of forgetting God. And because you forgot God, he's not going to let you go into the land of Israel.
Yeah. Okay. And in terms of one other very interesting passage that I hope you'll talk about is when you talk about King David and thinking about oneself. King David, as you note, is one of the most interesting characters in the Bible. He thinks about himself. But one couldn't really call what he does a profound kind of self-reflection. He seduces Bathsheba, arranges for the death of her husband in battle, and the prophet Nathan points out to him that there will be consequences for this. He's profoundly remorseful, but it's hard for us to recognize in what he goes through anything that we would really consider profound self-reflection. How does the character of David and the narrative of the story of David help us think about the concept of the self and the shift that you talk about in this book?
Right. Well, David, I agree with you. He is such a fascinating figure in the Bible. But in this case, he's already, you know, he's committed a terrible sin. The prophet, you know, tells him that it is terrible and that he's going to be punished, and that the baby that is going to be born to Bathsheba will die. And you know, this guy's a tough guy. He's a guerrilla fighter, mm-hmm. but this just totally, you know, horrifies him. And he does, you know, lies on the floor and won't eat and, you know, does whatever he can to stave off this horrible punishment. And the baby dies. And then, you know, he says, okay, well, let's have something to eat now. And, you know, aren't you going to mourn? I mean, you know, this is your baby who's died. And so, look, I'm not going to see that kid again until I go to the underworld after my death. There's no point in, you know, my weeping and wailing now. I did that in order to try to stave off the punishment that was assigned. But since it's been carried out, it's over. Mm-hmm. And again, this is a guy who doesn't seem to be reflective of a kind of complex psyche, such as one encounters later on. And, I think that's another piece of evidence to put in this evolving story.
Right. Finally, I want to ask you how this will change, how you see this changing the direction of your scholarship and perhaps even Jewish biblical scholarship writ large. The idea that you really explore in this book has led you into a sort of interdisciplinary form of work that's very intriguing, but that many might be hesitant to follow because of their lack of expertise or experience or the breadth of interest and knowledge that, for example, you have. How would you like to see scholarship and observance incorporate these ideas into the future?
Well, scholarship and observance are two quite different things.
And I ask you that question. I'm terribly sorry to ask a two-part question, but I hope you will not mind addressing both, and you can address one at a time. But I wanted to ask you both as someone who lives an observant Jewish life and someone who is a prominent scholar.
Well, I guess I would answer about the first part. I don't think there's anything that I say that is not. I think I may be about a week ahead of the crest of the wave. There are a lot of people now who are interested in trying to figure out, trying to look at these biblical texts again and see what that can tell us from the standpoint of a modern anthropologist or someone who's acquainted with even ultimately neuroscience, mm-hmm. and what they can say about what's going on in the evolving sense of self that I tried to document in this book. So I just think that's where scholarship is about to go, or is maybe even going right now. Mm-hmm. As an observant Jew, I think that that ultimately we look to the very foundation of Judaism, which is commandments, mitzvot. That's what this religion consists of, and the idea of it is that approaching God, seeking to use the terms of my title, to encounter God, people, as I put it in the book, you can't walk into God's office and put your feet up on the desk. He's not your friend. And so the traditional Jewish notion of how to come before God is to come as his servant. Actually in Hebrew, it's the same word as slave, which sounds pretty debased. But as I always used to tell students, I guess it all depends who your employer is. In this case, that's the very essence of Judaism. You say, I want to come before you in order to serve you. I once quoted this sort of mashal, rabbinic parable, about the guy who wants to see the king, and he goes and stands outside the palace. But of course, there's a big metal gate all around it, and so he can just stand there. And he does. After a few hours, the king comes out of the palace, and he's really thrilled. I got to see the king. And the next day, he goes back, and the next day is rainy, and so he doesn't see the king. And the day after that, anyway, time goes on, and what was first thrilling to him becomes frustrating. And finally, one of the king's servants, who spotted him through the rails of this fence, comes up to him and says, "Well, you're doing the wrong thing. If you really want to see the king, you ought to go to the Royal Employment Office and fill out a form, you know, get a job. Doesn't really matter what, you know, sweeping up or being a security guard, but that way you'll get to see God all the time, and he may even get to notice you. And I think that that's the whole idea of mitzvot in Judaism, that it's your ticket inside the palace.
I think that is a wonderful note on which to end a delightful discussion. I have been talking today with James L. Kugel, the Star Professor Emeritus of Hebrew Literature at Harvard University, and we have been discussing his new book, The Great Shift, Encountering God in Biblical Times, published in 2017 by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Professor Kugel, it's been a real privilege. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.